This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The big event at the Republican convention tonight is Sarah Palin's speech. We're going to talk about Palin with two Los Angeles Times reporters covering the campaign. Peter Walston is reporting from the Republican convention. Tom Hamburger is in Anchorage reporting on Palin's background. In today's edition of the LA Times, Hamburger co-wrote a story about Palin and earmarks. The article says, three times in recent years, McCain's lists of objectionable pork spending have included earmarks requested by his new running mate. We're also going to talk about the Republicans' campaign strategy, how Palin figures into it, and the extent to which the Republicans are using techniques from the Karl Rove playbook. Hamburger and Walston co-wrote the 2006 book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Peter Walston, Tom Hamburger, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's compare what you're each learning about Sarah Palin. Let's just start with an overview of how popular does she seem to be now. And Tom, you're in Anchorage, so let's start with you. How popular has Sarah Palin been as a mayor and governor, as far as you can tell?
Well, I'm in the place where Sarah Palin would like you to ask about her popularity. Her approval ratings, according to state polls and the state politicians I'm talking to, is running in the 80%, 80-plus level. She is an enormously popular figure here for a number of reasons, one of which is that she has recently pushed through legislation which is going to provide a $1,200 check to every Alaskan in the form of a rebate from oil revenues.
That's to every single person, including children, babies, so like every single member of a family gets that check.
That's my understanding. It's a $1,200 per person rebate to help with high fuel costs.
So what else accounts for her popularity?
Well, her popularity comes from was building long before she authored the rebate request in the legislature. She's a hockey mom. She's the small-town mayor, striking-looking former mayor who is plain-talking and won over Alaskans in her several races, in her two races for statewide office, once for lieutenant governor and successfully for governor in 2006. And she has spoken out. In Alaska, there have been two big news stories that have been dominating the front pages here and coffee shop discussion. One is the rise in oil prices and the demand for oil, and that's Alaska's chief industry and chief product. And the second has been the corruption scandal, which has reached through the Republican Party here. Sarah Palin's response to both of those have been just what Alaskans are looking for. On the oil, she's gone after the big oil companies, demanding more revenues for the state from them. And of the Republican Party, she's been demanding reform, calling out and publicly criticizing the once dominant political figures here, Senator Ted Stevens and Representative Don Young, who were previously her mentors.
Now, Palin is being touted as a maverick. It's hard to count how many times I've heard the word maverick in the past few days about McCain and Palin. McCain is opposed to earmarks, and his campaign says she's opposed to earmarks, too. Tom, you're in Anchorage, and you have a piece in today's LA Times, which explains about how the reality of her policy on earmarks is a little bit different from what we've been hearing. In fact, McCain specifically objected to earmarks that were requested by Palin when she was mayor of the town of Wasilla. Can you give us some examples of some of the things that she specifically requested earmarks for? And for anyone who is a little confused, explain what an earmark is.
Sure. An earmark is the legislative request that a member of Congress makes that is very narrowly drawn to pull federal funds or direct federal funds in an appropriations bill to a specific project or company. John McCain has become in Congress probably the best known opponent of this earmark system, saying that it's secretive and leads to irrational spending. And yet it is used by almost every member of Congress and thought about by almost every mayor and certainly every governor who now under earmark reform laws must disclose their earmark requests. Earmark requests are publicly disclosed. when they go to members of Congress making these requests. Alaska, with its powerful congressional delegation and Senator Stevens on the chair of the Appropriations Committee, was the state that per capita did far better than any other state in getting these earmarks. When Sarah Palin was introduced to the public standing at John McCain's side in Dayton a week ago, she announced her displeasure with earmarks and even referred to a project in Alaska, which has become kind of the poster child for bad earmark spending, the so-called Bridge to Nowhere, a bridge in a rural area of Alaska. The reality, though, is that Sarah Palin, when she was mayor and as governor, made use of the earmark system, making contact with that powerful congressional delegation and asking for specific funding for specific projects. She even engaged in the old-fashioned system, which McCain decries, of hiring a Washington lobbyist to help get these earmarks. They paid a Washington lobbyist, a guy named Steve Silver, who used to work for Senator Stevens, to represent her hometown, the city of Wasilla, where she was mayor, and helped secure earmarks of, depending on how you count it, between about $11 and $26 million in earmarks during the time she was mayor. And that's for that's an extraordinary figure for a town of about 9,700 people.
Now, at the speech that Sarah Palin gave right after John McCain announced her as his running mate, she talked about her rejection of earmarks and specifically the project known as the Bridge to Nowhere. And she said, "I told Congress thanks, but no thanks on that Bridge to Nowhere. If our state wanted a bridge, I said, we'd build it ourselves." What's the reality about what happened with the money for the Bridge to Nowhere when Sarah Palin became governor of Alaska?
Well, when the reality is that Sarah Palin, to recall an expression from campaigns past, was for the Bridge to Nowhere before she was against it. The bridge refers to the Gravina Island Bridge, which is a proposed structure to replace a ferry that connects Ketchikan, Alaska, with Gravina Island, where the town's airport is. And when she was running for governor in 2006, Sarah Palin spoke positively about the Bridge to Nowhere, saying it was something that she thought would be a good idea to build. When she campaigned around Ketchikan, she supported the idea. After her election, she had, and this is the explanation the campaign provides, she took a look at budget realities and realized there were other priorities in the state. She didn't return the money for the bridge to the federal government, but rather kept it to use for other public works projects in Alaska.
So she rejected the idea of using the earmark money for the bridge, but she didn't exactly send back the earmark money.
She didn't send it back to the Treasury.
Right.
To work on other Alaska road projects.
Peter, you're covering the campaign, so you're in the Twin Cities. There's been nothing but like real positive talk coming out of the campaign about Sarah Palin. Have you heard any behind-the-scenes doubts expressed about John McCain's choice?
Oh yeah. You know, the grassroots is extremely excited about her. But when you talk privately with, and even some of them not so privately, Republican strategists, there's definitely a divide. There are those who are in the business of thinking about politics and winning elections who are very worried because it wasn't long ago that John McCain and his campaign were talking about their winning strategy of appealing to the middle, of winning independent voters, moderate voters, trying to take people away who maybe have voted, either not voted in the past or voted Democratic in the past. And this was going to be McCain's strategy. Now they worry that Palin is going to turn off those moderate voters. They just don't know. They're worried about is there another shoe left to drop? They worry that the McCain campaign, as we're learning, did not really aggressively vet Sarah Palin. It turns out that sources tell us John McCain really wanted to put Joe Lieberman on the ticket, and only in the closing hours his advisors convinced him that that would lead to a revolt here at the Republican convention, would really anger the base, already skeptical of McCain anyway. So at the last minute, he decided to pick Sarah Palin, and it turns out they really didn't do much vetting. So now folks like Tom are doing the vetting, and we'll see what they find. But this is not the way these campaign strategists would like it to have played out. They would like to know everything that's out there to know. So there's some anxiety, certainly. But on the flip side, I was at a discussion yesterday with some Republicans, some conservative leaders, fiscal conservatives and social conservatives, kind of some of the and business leaders, the main pillars of the Republican movement. And they're very excited about her, assuming that she can survive this, because she still does have appeal to the middle. Her husband is a member of the Steelworkers Union. The Republicans still believe that labor union members are winnable. You know, Bush won 40% of labor union members. They are tend to be socially conservative in many ways, the middle class. This is Sarah Palin's story. So there's anxiety, there's uncertainty, and there's fear, but also a little bit of hope.
You mentioned that it turns out that the McCain campaign didn't thoroughly vet Sarah Palin because the process was so rushed. Are you convinced that the McCain campaign or that Palin herself knew that her daughter was pregnant?
You know, there's the McCain campaign. At this point, all we can do is take them at their word that they knew about it. What they haven't been specific about is exactly when they found out. How early in the process or whether it was actually before McCain made his decision. They say it is. We'll take them at their word. I think the issue with the pregnancy is not so much that her daughter is pregnant. I think most people are willing to let that be a family matter, but there are a private family matter, but there are a couple of issues with it that people are identifying. One is, again, this question of what did the McCain vetters know about her, and were they prepared for this? And secondly, there's a little bit of a disconnect that on the one hand, the campaign is saying, you know, this is a family matter, leave the family out of it. But on the other hand, they are definitely talking. They seem to be happy to discuss, to accuse the media and Democrats of trying to poke into a private family matter. And it turns out we've now learned that the father of her daughter's baby will be coming to the convention to create the picture of a happy family. And the news broke because the campaign announced it.
I think there's a policy issue here, too. And that's abstinence-only education, which Sarah Palin is very much in support of. She's against the teaching about birth control. The Republican platform says abstinence from sexual activity is the only protection that is 100% effective against out-of-wedlock pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases. The Republican platform opposes teaching about contraception. And so when you see Sarah Palin's 17-year-old daughter who's pregnant and out of wedlock, you have to ask yourself, is abstinence-only education as effective as its advocates think? And, you know, what does that say about the platform? So I wonder how the policy end of that question is playing. Is anybody talking about that at the convention or in Alaska?
If I can answer the Alaska portion of it quickly, Terry. It's it is being discussed in Alaska. That is her daughter's pregnancy is being talked about. I was at the state fair the other day and talked to people from in Palmer, which is just a few miles from Wasilla, where the Palin family lives. The people, young and old, particularly the young people there, Terry, said they knew that their daughter Bristol was pregnant. It was pretty well known in town, and this was not a secret. Seems unlikely it's a secret she could have kept or would have kept from John McCain in any case. And her political supporters here see it as this pregnancy as potentially something that gives her an opportunity to again show that she is not your typical vice presidential candidate. Frequently people were saying it shows that she's like us, she's like the rest of us. And I can tell you if and when the topic turns to teen pregnancy, while her views are very much as you just described, in favor of abstinence education, supporting parental notification before a teenager gets an abortion, And she also has very strong views on limiting exceptions for no exceptions for abortion. But having said that, this is a topic that her friends and people in Wasilla who know her and political figures in Alaska say she's comfortable discussing. And if there's going to be a national discussion on teen pregnancy, they think she'll do very well leading it.
Terry, can I add to that? It goes exactly to the point of why, in many ways, Sarah Palin is Karl Rove's dream candidate. this issue, think about it. On the one hand, she's able to talk about how proud she is that her daughter is going to have the baby. Opponents of abortion love that conversation. They like that as an example. It's the same conversation they like when Sarah Palin talks about why she brought her own baby to term, even though the baby had Down syndrome. So that's something that's very popular with the base. On the other hand, Republicans I'm talking to in the and campaign advisors feel that Democrats who try to tread into this territory do so at their peril, because this is an inherently middle-class issue. This is the kind of thing that they feel helps her relate to many, many people around the country. Parents of teenagers know how difficult it is to raise children, to control them. And so this is, again, makes her someone that can relate to middle-class America. So in a way, this can help her with the base. It also can help her with those now famous blue-collar Democrats who did not support Barack Obama in the primaries and could be looking to think about John McCain in the general election.
Sarah Palin was chosen in part to mobilize the base, the Republican base, to mobilize the evangelical voters, and she seems to be doing that very successfully. Tom, in Anchorage, have you learned if her religious views have affected her policies either as mayor or governor?
Terry, here's what her religious views are well known. She is this outspoken opponent of abortion. She has talked publicly and favorably about teaching creationism in public schools. But in the public realm, at least in the short time in which she's been governor, she has avoided on a couple of occasions dealing with these issues. And that has won her some applause. On the creationism in schools topic, she promised during the campaign, she said that while I favor it, it's not my priority and it's not something that I'm going to be pushing as governor, and indeed she has not done that. She also vetoed a bill or did not move forward with legislation in her first term that would have limited the rights of gay couples. She didn't discuss that, and I believe there was also some abortion legislation that she didn't look at, in part, she said, because she didn't want to be deterred from her first priority, which was passing this legislation which would provide more oil revenue to the people of Alaska. So she was very focused on that, and that seems to be her holy grail. Now, as mayor, there were reports of her discussing with the librarians and saying that some of the folks from her church and people she talked to objected to some books in the library. The librarians, at least the folks who know the library that we talked to, said that while she raised that question, she did not actually proceed to try to ban books or limit them. So she seems to be to have these very strong views, and yet on the other hand, put her sort of economic, her conservative economic views, almost libertarian views in some cases, ahead of those conservative social values.
Sarah Palin doesn't think that climate change is connected to human activity, and I'm wondering how that's affected, if you know how that's affected, her energy and environmental policies in Alaska, a state that's being very directly affected by climate change. Part of the permafrost is melting, the ecological balance is changing because of climate change in that state.
Terry, I do. There is quite a bit of talk about that, particularly from Alaska's a small but vocal environmental community. Sarah Palin, since she was governor, actually took exception to the Bush administration's decision just a few months ago to declare the polar bear an endangered species. There were 9 separate studies that were led by an Interior Department scientist based here in Anchorage across the Bering Sea and across the polar region, looking at the dramatic decline in polar bear habitat. Some of the reports reported polar bears, sightings of polar bears swimming in areas where there used to be ice fields. And it led Interior Secretary Kempthorne to declare them an endangered species. Sarah Palin said the best science that she's seen does not, in fact, indicate that polar bear is endangered, and she is protesting and appealing that status that was granted by the Interior Department. She opposes it. She thinks that she has a kind of her position on global warming is that warming is occurring, but it's not related to human activity. And one of the, that's sort of a perfect position, you know, for an Alaska governor like her, because it allows the economic activity of oil and gas drilling to go on unmitigated. On the other hand, it allows her to apply for federal aid to deal with the flooding, the changes in the permafrost, and other environmental factors that might be helped with some federal support and studies.
Tom, most of the things you've said about Sarah Palin describe her as being very popular in Alaska. And I'm wondering if you've heard negative things about her during your research in Anchorage.
Terry, the answer is yes. And some of the things we've heard suggest the nature of the High Wire Act that is going to occur tonight at the Republican Party. Remember, she's not terribly experienced on the national stage. She has a temperament that's described as brittle, and there's a record of her firing people, really, you know, tossing them out of jobs they've held for a long time if they cross her in one way or another. A sort of a loyalty test, a brittleness around personal issues, an ego that is easily pricked and damaged. And on her economic record, this is a governor, remember, whose chief accomplishment was, in a sense, to raise taxes on oil companies. Her record as mayor also is not one of at least some of her critics point out, not one of great fiscal care. Taxes were increased while she was mayor, and there was a big expansion of the city's debt. So those kind of things are going to haunt her tonight as she speaks. We'll see how she does for the first time on the national stage. And then there's going to be a lot of picking away at her limited but very visible record in this state. One of the things that we've encountered as reporters here is a rather extensive, the arrival of an extensive or large team of Republican Party and campaign operatives who are answering questions for the candidate and even for local officials who we try to interview. So it seems that there's not only concern among some, even some of her friends locally, about whether there are embarrassments in that record, but the campaign has moved into Alaska to try to either paper over or explain inconsistencies in her, or problems in her record.
You say she's done well economically in Alaska. Alaska's a very unique economy in that
Absolutely. It's
so oil-based.
Yes.
It has oil there, so it's not a typical state.
Oh, not at all. And she, it's one of the, as the rest of the nation, in a sense, suffers from these high oil prices. It's one of the things that Alaskans are conscious of. This is their major industry. There are state funds that return to the people oil company revenues, profits, taxes, if you will, and those are working. And they're smiling on their smiles on the faces of Alaskans, in part because they are benefiting financially from these high prices and the boom in demand for gas and oil.
And Sarah Palin has raised the amount of money that people are getting in these oil dividends, but isn't there some controversy over whether that money should actually be going into infrastructure instead of being given to individuals?
You're absolutely right. There is the number of the good government activists in Alaska. Some Democrats are saying this returning this $1,200 dividend check to all Alaskans is not good policy. There are things that the state needs, and we need to sort of consider that more rationally. Governor Palin, perhaps in exhibiting once again her political skills, has decided no. Alaskans, even while the economy is benefiting from this boom in demand, are still paying higher fuel costs. We're going to return this money to the people, and it's been a very popular move.
I'm just wondering, though, she's returning oil dividends to individuals as opposed to investing them in infrastructure, and at the same time she's gone after earmarks, which means that taxpayers from the rest of the United States are paying for Alaska's infrastructure?
Well, there's something of a tradition in Alaska, both from the going back to the period when Alaska first became a state. It has received inordinate funding from the per capita funding for the federal government for infrastructure. Part of the justification is that so much of the land in Alaska is federally owned, that this is a way of sort of returning some benefit to the population. But that's a long, well-trod path in Alaska politics, actually, to create or to bring home the bacon from Washington and provide federal funding for basic infrastructure needs.
Sarah Palin has really changed the whole shape and direction of the McCain campaign. You both co-authored a book about the Republican strategy for winning in the 21st century, and a lot of that book is about the strategies created by Karl Rove, who helped elect and re-elect, I mean, who was the architect of the election and re-election campaign of President George W. Bush. How does the Sarah Palin pick as McCain's running mate change the direction that the campaign is heading in and what's going to be emphasized within the campaign, who the campaign is appealing to? Peter, you want to take that?
Sure, Terry. Sarah Palin, because of her popularity with the base, has transformed this campaign. You know, it wasn't long ago that John McCain and his campaign advisors were talking pretty openly about how he was going to win if he was going to win the White House, it was going to be with a much different model than the Karl Rove plan. Karl Rove focused on motivating the Republican conservative base and expanding that base by finding new unaffiliated voters who were naturally conservative but maybe not politically involved. So they would simply change the electorate. They would win by changing and growing their piece of the electorate. John McCain, because of his image as his independence, his image as a quote-unquote maverick, they felt that he could actually win the middle, go after those swing voters, the independent voters that in the past maybe have been unaffiliated or voted Democratic, so-called Reagan Democrats that did support President Reagan. And at the same time, they felt that McCain was never going to mobilize the base. Well, now it turns out apparently that strategy wasn't working out. They were never getting above a certain threshold that they felt they needed to have a chance of beating Barack Obama in national polls and also in battleground states. So obviously they made a decision that they did want to maybe go back a little bit to that strategy. So they chose Sarah Palin, now very much a hero of the conservative base, and it's completely changed the feel and look of this campaign. The convention hall here in St. Paul is totally energized in a way that it just would not have been for John McCain and, say, a running mate of if it were someone who supported abortion rights such as Tom Ridge or Joe Lieberman. So we're going to see a much different campaign, and I think that this is very much the culmination of what we've seen over the past several months, which is McCain inching back, walking back into that Karl Rove strategy for winning, the strategy that we wrote about in One Party Country. It seems that the McCain campaign has now moved entirely to that model, and this is where they're going to plant their flag.
I'm wondering, like, which came first, McCain deciding, you know, I think I want to choose Sarah Palin, or the campaign deciding the direction you need to go to win is to re-energize the base and not work so hard on winning the middle?
Well, you began to see that change a couple of months ago. There was a leadership change in the campaign. The kind of senior advisor who's now guiding campaign strategy is Steve Schmidt, who was a major player in the Bush reelection campaign in 2004, went on to work for Governor Schwarzenegger, actually. But now he seems to be guiding the campaign back into the Bush-Rove model, and there are some other Bush, there's at least one other Bush strategist now on McCain's inner circle advising him. So we began to see that happen, and you could also see it with McCain's policy shifts over the past couple of years. He now supports the Bush tax cuts that he once opposed. He now supports expanded oil drilling, which he once opposed. These are conservative, these are core beliefs that are held by conservative Republicans, and he finally was convinced that these are the views he would have to hold in order to mobilize that base.
One of the things that you wrote about in your book about the Karl Rove strategy to win elections is micro-targeting or niche marketing, basically taking voters who had been perceived as voting blocks and breaking off little bites from those blocks So you're talking about like African-American voters, Jewish voters, the labor vote, so that you subdivide that vote. So it doesn't, that vote doesn't go completely Democrat. You take a bite out of it, put it into the Republican side, and in a very divided country, every little bite helps weight things to your side. So how do you think the micro-targeting is playing out during this campaign where you have Barack Obama, an African-American, as the Democratic presidential nominee, and now Sarah Palin, an evangelical, and a woman as the vice presidential Republican choice?
Well, Terry, the micro-targeting is still very much alive, but this is one part of the plan that that really hit major stumbling blocks. Of course, Hurricane Katrina contributed. African American, there had been growing African American support, especially among socially conservative evangelical blacks, for at least an openness to the Republican Party. President Bush nationally didn't expand his black vote that much in 2004, but in certain battleground states such as Ohio, he did. Now, obviously, Obama is winning 90% or more of the African American vote. McCain, I think there's very little hope for the Republicans to dig too deep into that. It's just the African American community is extremely excited about the historic nature of Obama's candidacy. Also, Hispanics was a major focus of the Karl Rove plan, and that has really been damaged because of the immigration debate. We're seeing now Obama, the latest polls show Obama winning about 65-66% of the Latino vote, and John McCain winning less than 30%. Karl Rove has said on numerous occasions that Republicans need to win at least 40% of the Hispanic vote, if not aiming for 50%, to have a chance to return to power. And so there's no indication that this election that will happen. John McCain, this is one area where he did, again, change his views over time. He was really a hero in to many Latinos, because McCain, from Arizona, with a heavy Hispanic population, was an advocate for comprehensive immigration reform, including a path to citizenship, really stood up to his party and took a lot of heat for it. But during the Republican primary, basically swallowed its pride and said, hey, I learned my lesson. We have to do border security before anything else. Now he's kind of moved back to saying that he's for the path to citizenship. He's been vague about whether or not it would have to happen at the same time as border security or after it. But Hispanic Americans, Latinos, have really looked at this and are not impressed with the Republican Party right now. And frankly, the Democrats have done a very good job of cutting into that. And the Obama campaign is spending millions and millions of dollars. I think it's going to wind up being more than any campaign has ever spent in history on courting the Latino vote with Spanish language advertising, radio and television, and newspaper advertising. The McCain campaign is also doing a very aggressive outreach campaign. So far, it hasn't had any effect. And this is going to be one reason why it's, again, very difficult for McCain to win this time. But he still has the opportunity to turn that around as well.
One of the things that's been very helpful to the Republicans and the Republican electoral strategy is Grover Norquist's weekly meetings. And Norquist is the head of Americans for Tax Reform. He's very opposed to, I think, any and all taxes. And he, for the past few years, has held weekly meetings that have brought together a wide array of conservative groups to find a common agenda and to come up with common talking points. And that's helped keep conservative groups with different interests on the same page and united together. Norquist has not been a fan of John McCain's. Is Norquist mobilizing his people for McCain? How much power does Norquist and those weekly meetings have now?
Terry, the weekly meeting that's held at the Americans Tax Reform is still the central meeting place for conservatives in Washington, kind of the nerve center. John McCain, since he secured the nomination, has been sending a representative, sometimes his very top campaign people, to the meeting. There is an exchange of information, and Norquist has, the Americans for Tax Reform, has chapters in some multiple chapters in some states, but a chapter in I think 46 states. And from what we're told, his network will be activated and working for the campaign. He and McCain have patched up their once very significant differences, and the conservative movement, at least as represented by that Wednesday meeting and by Norquist, is working with the McCain campaign.
Is it fair to say that John McCain has kind of taken a 180 politically in order to try to win this election?
Well, it depends on the issue. I don't want to be evasive here, but on a number of issues, he has taken a 180, and I think he's taken a 180 strategically. So yes, I mean, he is doing what he believes is necessary to win the election. I mean, that was one of the criticisms from some Republican strategists that I heard, is his entire campaign theme is country first. But when it came time to choose a running mate, he chose somebody that that some believe isn't well known enough, is not a known quantity, simply because she helped him politically, that it was a political choice, which is not necessarily a trademark of John McCain. In that sense, it seems that John McCain has become a much different kind of candidate, certainly, than he was in 2000. Whether that's a full 180 or not, I can't say. But we've seen a lot of changes, and this is a much different, much more conventional Republican campaign than we once expected from John McCain.
Just name a couple of the issues that he has really changed on.
He has really changed on tax cuts. He voted in 2001 and 2003 against the Bush tax cuts, and not only voted against them, but if you read the transcript of his speeches on the Senate floor, he condemned the fact that these were tax cuts for the rich at the expense of the middle class, very much adopting the populist rhetoric from the Democrats in their opposition to the tax cuts. That is the very kind of rhetoric that Grover Norquist and the conservative movement really, really hates. But now McCain says, well, he opposed it only because there wasn't the tax cuts didn't come with enough spending restraint by the government. That's now his stated reason for having opposed it then. Now he supports keeping those tax cuts permanent because he says they would be a tax increase and he would never support a tax increase. So that's one of the major examples of a policy shift. Of course, he also now supports expanded oil drilling. He has not yet changed his mind on drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Of course, Sarah Palin is a big proponent of that. So now he has some cover on that issue. And again, on immigration, he was a champion for a pathway to citizenship, which working with Ted Kennedy, of all people, on that issue. And now we're hearing a much more nuanced position where he talks about the need for border security. And yes, it's true that he's gone to some Latino groups and been cheered for his views that are certainly more open to a path to citizenship than many conservatives. He's still also kind of sticking to some conservative talking points on that issue. So those are some major shifts that we've seen in John McCain over the last couple of years.
Do you see this election in a way as a test of the Rovian strategy when it's used up against a candidate who's very different in his approach, like Barack Obama?
Well, in some ways it is a test of the Rovian strategy because we see both campaigns using it. Now, the McCain campaign, as we've discussed, is using it, but the Obama campaign and the Democrats are using micro-targeting to the hilt. In fact, there are some who believe that the Democrats may have surpassed the Republicans now because they looked at the 2004 playbook. David Plouffe, Barack Obama's campaign manager, has said repeatedly over the last couple of weeks, he gave a briefing in Denver at the convention last week that I was at, where he spoke in glowing terms about what he learned by watching the Republicans in 2004 and how they are to be admired for how they got out the vote, how they found their voters and got them to the polls. And that is what the Obama campaign is doing now. And the whole Obama strategy of expanding the electorate is exactly what Karl Rove did in 2004. So not only is this year a test of the Rovian strategy, but we're going to see it happening on both sides. And this is really a test of which side is better at the Rovian strategy right now.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you so much. Good to talk with you again.
You too,
Terry.
Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston cover politics for the LA Times. Walston is reporting on the Republican convention. Hamburger is in Anchorage writing about Sarah Palin. They co-wrote the 2006 book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Any new scraps of information, any new interpretive slants on the life of reclusive poet Emily Dickinson intrigue readers because there's so little that's known about her day-to-day existence. Biographer Brenda Wineapple has written a new book that focuses on Dickinson's friendship, mostly carried out through letters, with writer Thomas Wentworth Higginson. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Wineapple's tight focus yields up a surprisingly in-depth portrait of the poet.
Conventional wisdom has it you can tell a lot about a person by the company he or she keeps. But what if posterity makes a big mistake in judging a famous somebody's friends? Wouldn't that blunder then trigger a huge misreading of the chief person of interest? There you have the reasoning underlying Brenda Wineapple's fascinating new book, White Heat, that explores the relationship between Emily Dickinson and one of her closest confidants, Thomas Wentworth Higginson. For decades, Higginson has been derided by Dickinson's scholars and fans as a kindly oaf, a Victorian man of minor letters, damned with a tin ear. It was Higginson, after all, who helped edit Dickinson's poems for their posthumous debut publication. To make them palatable to readers of the time, Higginson fed her five-alarm flammable poems about passion and death and the afterlife through the Victorian deflavorizing machine, watering down their offbeat punctuation and vocabulary. Back to conventional wisdom again. The fact that Dickinson originally requested the stodgy Higginson's literary guidance in 1862, when he was a contributor to the Atlantic Monthly magazine and she was a nobody, surely testifies to her naivete, her recluse of Amherst otherworldliness. Balderdash, says Brenda Wineapple. While Higginson may not have been the defiant editor that Dickinson's poetry deserved, neither was he a wimp. Among other attributes, Higginson was a fierce advocate for women's rights, a staunch supporter of John Brown, and the commander of the 1st Union Regiment of African American soldiers during the Civil War, a unit that predated the far more famous Massachusetts 54th, led by Robert Gould Shaw. Higginson may not have entirely gotten the enigmatic Dickinson, who does, but nevertheless she told him that he was the friend that saved my life. In White Heat, Wineapple sets out to restore to Dickinson the brave friend and literary advisor that she had the sense to seek out. In re-injecting the moxie back into Higginson's veins, Wineapple also gives Dickinson more juice. Wineapple opens her superb account of this friendship with the famous letter the 31-year-old poet sent to the 38-year-old Higginson after he had written what you might call an advice column in the Atlantic Monthly addressed to hopeful contributors. The letter began, "Are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive? Should you think it breathed, and had you the leisure to tell me, I should feel quick gratitude." Wineapple takes off from that fateful moment, tracing the separate and intertwined lives of the friends, who, by the way, only met twice. Higginson recalled that he had never met anyone who drained my nerve power so much. The only thing unavoidably lacking in Wineapple's account is the fact that his letters to Dickinson vanished after her death. Another mystery among the multitudes surrounding this cipher. But Wineapple is a shrewd reader of the letters that do exist, as well as of the poems. Indeed, as much as it's a highly engaging critical biography, White Heat is a book for anyone who just wants to revel in acrobatic language. Dickinson's, it goes without saying, but also Higginson's and Wineapple's own. Here, for instance, is a passage in which Wineapple turns away from the progression of her biography to meditate on Dickinson. As the woman in white, savant and reclusive, shorn of context, place, and reference, she seems to exist outside of time, untouched by it. And that's unnerving. No wonder we make up stories about her. And when we turn to her poems, we find that they too, like her life, stop the narrative. Lyric outbursts, they tell us no tales about who did what to whom in the habitable world. Perhaps they unsettle us so because Dickinson writes of experiences that we, who live in time, can barely name. That assessment verges near the circumference of hocus pocus, but treads gently back. As White Heat illuminates, not only was Emily Dickinson lucky to find a loyal, perceptive friend in Thomas Higginson, but she also continues to be graced with astute and eloquent biographers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed White Heat, The Friendship of Emily Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson by Brenda Wineapple. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.